This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Microchips are both important and in short supply. So, how important and what can be done to make them more plentiful? Also, what are the geopolitical implications of having the production of microchips concentrated in relatively few hands, which is what's happened? Well, for enlightenment on these issues, I'm joined today by Julian Camassa, who researches the microchip for the think tank of the Center for Security Studies in Zurich. So, welcome to you.
Thanks, Owen, for having me.
And just first of all, what exactly is a microchip?
Well, microchip is basically a very indispensable part of daily life. In fact, they are built into almost all kinds of modern devices. Think of fridges, think of washing machines. They are in your computer, in your smartphone, in your cars. You have loads of them. What they do there is they perform essential control, computing, and storage function. Let me give you an example here. For example, the modern systems in cars, for example, they wouldn't work without microchips. We see that now in cars made in Russia. Quite famously, what is not possible with the absence of high tech. And that's basically a car which is like one of the 1960s.
That's interesting. So you're saying that Russian cars tend not to have microchips now, and therefore, what, their braking systems aren't as good and their various other functions don't work as well?
Yes, also systems that would prevent more pollution. This Lada, now they are selling, it does not have any emergency assistance systems. Airbags, I think, are missing. AC is missing. So, you know, all kinds of steering functions, they run on chips. Also, to give you an example, the water boiling unit in a coffee machine is also regulated by a chip. Or if you want to generate electricity from a solar panel, you need a chip as well. So they're in our daily lives and they become apparent when they're absent, essentially.
Yeah. And is it right to think of them as like mini computers? Is that basically one way to look at it?
I wouldn't necessarily go as far as to refer to them as mini computers, but there are different kinds of chips, and they are low-end chips which basically regulate the temperature, for example, and that is their only task. Or in a washing machine, they also make sure that the task is done. And how is that possible? It's possible through semiconducting material, which conducts small amounts of electricity and carries out tasks. Hence, semiconductors and chips are referred to interchangeably. But I'll use the term chip because it's just a bit shorter and easier.
Yeah, I was wondering about that, because there's microchips, there's semiconductors, there's microprocessors. Silicon chips is the same as chips, isn't it? So if you look at semiconductors and microprocessors, can you help us with what are the slight distinctions there?
Well, a microprocessor is, I would say, it's a bit like a human's brain. It processes incoming information. It can execute tasks. It can perform operation. But unlike humans, a microprocessor is not per se intelligent. It cannot think freely and critically reflect upon things. However, it can process huge amounts of data, which our brains would be overwhelmed with. And of course, when you look at progress in computing power enabled, what we call AI, artificial intelligence, by now. And this is thanks to microprocessors, and they run on high-performance chips, on high-end chips. That's a different kind of chips than the low-end ones, which just do one task.
So the way to see it is that the microchip is a part of a microprocessor.
Yes, and a microprocessor wouldn't run without that high-end chip. And a lot of function is in our daily life, thanks to AI and machine learning, wouldn't run without these powerful microprocessors. Think of Google Maps and navigation, for example. That's based on making sense, making predictions, based on the current assessment of the situation. Netflix, Spotify too, suggests that whoever is listening to this very podcast right now may like similar podcasts to this one. So this is all thanks to computers becoming more intelligent.
Okay, that's the microprocessor. And then if I asked you about the semiconductor, what's the difference between the semiconductor and a microchip?
There is really none. It's a question of terminology. You know, a semiconductor is inside a chip. It conducts these amounts of electricity, and it can decide if there is conduction of electricity or no conduction on this binary principle. And it's made of semiconducting materials such as silicon. So, you know, it's a bit of a basis for a chip, but without the semiconductor, you wouldn't have a chip, but without a chip, you wouldn't have a semiconductor. So,
yeah, now I've got it. So we're starting with a semiconductor, and then we're getting a chip, and then we're on to the microprocessor. So that's great. So now then, if we just now talk about the chips, what is the difficulty in making them? They take a long time to make, don't they?
They do, and that is due to the fact that the industry is quite special. Very simplified and roughly speaking, there are three steps of the chip supply chain. First, you design a chip, then you produce it, and then you assemble it. The first two are called the so-called front end of the process, while assembly is considered to be the back end. The reality is, however, far more complex than these three steps, because take production, for example, this step itself consists of over 1,000 steps using more than 500 machines. Some of this equipment, just one machine, has a similar amount of suppliers, and so on. So it's a very complex industry.
If you were, let's say, a car manufacturer and you wanted some particularly sophisticated new microchip to perform some function, and you went to, you know, the factory, the people who make microchips, from the moment you asked them, look, I need this new microchip to do this, how long would it take for that microchip to arrive before it arrives in the car factory?
Well, it depends what kind of infrastructure is already in place, because the production process alone is about 3 to 4 months. That's just at the fabrication plant. But that assumes that the fabrication plant is standing there on the ground, has all necessary equipment, and it can run 24/7. It has personnel, of course, as well to run. This is not always the case. And building a fabrication plant takes a minimum amount of 2 years, but it can take up to 4 years until it's operational. And what you need to factor in as well is the amount of time for chip design. Chip design is very R&D intensive. You need to design the software for the chip. You know, to simplify things, chip design is a bit like the principle of function follows form. So you need to design a chip and ask yourself what is it supposed to do, and you need to ask yourself this quite some time in advance, because sometimes you don't have a fabrication plant that is able to make that chip. So in a way, chip designers need to anticipate a lot. Or they're very confident, like Apple, to say, we're going to set this standard in 5 years. And we're going to find a manufacturer that basically from scratch makes a fabrication plant just for us, for this very chip. And then we're going to set standards and make something great, like these famous M1 and M2 chips, which are now sold by Apple. So this is the way to go. And just the chip design of the latest and most sophisticated chips is a cost of $500 million. And the fabrication plant for this chip costs about $20 billion. And the return of this investment is a matter of years. So this kind of shows you how high the barriers to entry are. But now back to your question, as a car manufacturer, you don't necessarily need chips like Apple does. The chips used in cars are rather on the low end of things. So there you just need a good working relationship and a close one with the fabrication plants.
So if a car manufacturer is on the low end of this, what would be a high-end chip customer?
Companies that do microprocessors, for example. We have some of them. Graphics, you know, high resolution, the top end of things, memory, storage, functions, basically everything that is needed for high performance computers. And as we see what technology is able to do in our lives, it requires high computing power. It requires very high performance chips. And also energy efficient chips, because otherwise we would have even bigger problems with energy scarcity.
Now then, people may have heard of Moore's Law,
yeah.
which is this idea that the microchip becomes, I think, twice as efficient every 2 years. And, you know, it held true for a remarkably long time. Is that still holding true, or is Moore's Law, you know, is it past its sell-by date?
So far, it is still true, yes, at least and to a high extent, thanks to a European company called ASML, which is based in the Netherlands. Why is that the case? Because this company provides machines which are indispensable for the production process, because this equipment, the so-called extreme ultraviolet lithography, it enables to increase this number of transistors on a wafer. And only because of this increase, Moore's Law, I would say, is still true. There are, however, opinions that this development may reach its tipping point, maybe also already in this decade, because when more transistor density requires so much cooling power that this energy would have to be used at the expense of energy needed for the transistor itself, then Moore's Law might basically meet the realities of what we call trade-offs.
That's right. You mean, you explained it better, because actually what Moore said was the number of transistors on the microchip would double
exactly
every 2 years. Yeah. So okay, now then, just we're going to sort of get into the geopolitics of this now, having worked out what these things are and how they're used. So one sort of technical issue which is underpinning a lot of the geopolitical questions: can you fit surveillance systems, surveillance channels, as it were, on chips? Because obviously, if you can, That is very, very important, and it makes a big difference to a lot of things. If a country can produce a chip and sell it to another country, can they gather information from that chip as it's used?
I think what you're referring here to is this technical term, backdoors in hardware, right? It is problematic for three reasons. First, antivirus systems cannot detect it because it is built in the hardware. It happens, secondly, at manufacturing stage. And thirdly, it can therefore circumvent encryption systems. So yes, it is possible. But, and there's a big but, the malicious actor in question, whoever that is, this actor would have to know the exact purpose of a chip in advance and be somewhat involved in this manufacturing process of this very specific type of chip. You know, to give you an example, it is of little use to fit a surveillance system and monitor the temperature of someone's fridge. More interesting would be to fit surveillance in memory chips, for instance. But then again, memory chips for whom? And I doubt that this is very transparently known in a manufacturing plant or in an assembly plant. You can also install backdoors in servers or routers. You don't have to go into chips. Snowden's revelation about these NSA practices revealed that you can do a lot of damage doing this in servers and routers. And this is a bit easier because you open a package and in a postal delivery, and as a security agency, you can have probably access to this, although it's doubtful if that is legal in all kinds of systems. But, you know, the problem is out there for a decade. And of course, there are fears in the US about such Chinese activities. But what is also interesting that there have been developed some quite effective countermeasures. One of it is the so-called tychographic X-ray laminography. Now, this is a super technical term. I try to explain it in simpler ways. It is quite similar to biometric verification of our fingerprints. So you can make a 3D scan of a chip and verify if there were installed backdoors. So, you know, it is a fear. But then again, when you look at the barriers to entry, this actor needs to be at the right time in the right place. So personally, I think installing backdoors in software might be easier for a malicious actor.
That's very interesting. But just to be clear, if, let's say, China was making a mobile phone for the American market and it was producing the chips in China, then presumably if that whole process is occurring in China, they know perfectly well what the chip is for, then they could put a backdoor into that phone. Is that right?
Yes.
Right. Well, that does seem quite important. I mean, that does have a lot of implications then, doesn't it?
I mean, they could, and it's not a surprise that the current US administration banned all kinds of Huawei equipment just most recently. There has been no proof that this practice happened. But I guess their rationale is we don't want to wait for proof. We have reasons to believe this could happen. And when it happens, is already too late. And the US has its own tech supply chain. They have very powerful tech companies. So they are in the position to exclude these companies. Other countries are not in this position, of course.
Exactly. Well, let's get on to that now and ask who's making them and how all that works. So which countries can make chips?
Well, a whole range of them, but it depends which kind of chips do you refer to. I'll start with the high-end ones. And here, Taiwan and South Korea stand out. Taiwan, the famous company TSMC, it's huge. It's a huge company. The annual revenue is about $70 billion. So very, very lucrative business. They control about 60% of this contract manufacturing market. And TSMC is basically specialized in the high-end chips, meaning 10 nanometers and less. Now, just in order to avoid confusion, nanometers has no physical, it does not refer to any physical features. It's a marketing term for a certain process, how you make the chips, and it's marketing term for how powerful these chips are. So 5 nanometers or 3 nanometers doesn't mean the chips are getting smaller or smaller. It's just marketing terminology. And TSMC, as a contract manufacturer, is specialized on going into these high-performance chips. It's no coincidence that TSMC's most important customer is Apple. 25% of TSMC's revenue is thanks to Apple. TSMC's hardest competitor is Samsung, which is also foundry, but also a so-called integrated device manufacturer. These IDMs are companies which cover all kinds of steps, from chip design to manufacturing up to assembly, while TSMC is only active in fabrication. So the most advanced chips are made in Taiwan and South Korea, but also in the US. We have a lot of chips made in Europe as well, but they are not necessarily the most advanced one. Japan as well has some capacities.
Yeah, just to be clear about this distinction, Samsung can do the whole process.
Yes.
And in Taiwan, I think this is what you call a foundry. They
yes.
just have a foundry, which makes them. But who does the other steps in the process for the Taiwanese then?
Well, Apple designs its own chips, for example. Apple designs its own chips, and they come to TSMC saying, you know, we have this chip design. Please build a factory for us. We want to make them. And then a so-called outsourced semiconductor assembly and testing company does the whole assembly. So to explain it a bit clearer, there are currently two business operating models in the chip industry. One is the traditional one of these IDMs, companies like Intel, which cover most of the steps. They are still reliant on suppliers, of course, but they cover and are able to do most of the chips. And then the second business model, which came up with the most advanced chips, where there's a high degree of specialization and division of labor, where there's only one company highly specialized on one task, such as TSMC.
Now, what's a bit surprising about what you've said is that I think in every other field since, you know, the Second World War, let's say, the United States has led the way in terms of not just the R&D, but also the production. You know, you would expect this very high-tech industry to be based in the US. Why didn't that happen?
Well, it did happen, and quite interestingly, it's not the only sector this development shifted to Asia, where the US is the world's leading nation when it comes to chip design. And chip design is crucial because it sets the standards. And, you know, to tell you why this is important, when the US cuts off Chinese companies from its own chip design, which includes intellectual property, software, then this hurts. Because if you don't have this, you can't produce chips. You know, it's like the foundation to have know-how about how things work. And the US is leading here. It's also leading in this IDM business. US companies have about 50% market share there. It's rather the contract manufacturing, where South Korea and especially Taiwan are leading, and the US is lagging behind. But the customers for these foundries are still US-based. So let's not get confused here. The US is still in a leading position. They know a lot about this industry. And this is also reflected in export control measures targeting China, where it hurts, where China does not have anything to come up against because they are still reliant on US know-how.
Okay, so to be quite specific about it then, the thing the US lags in is these foundries. Is that right? Where they actually make the things?
Yes.
Okay. And why did that happen?
That happened for a variety of reasons. I think cost is one thing, because it was just cheaper to do it in Taiwan. Lack of industrial policy is another explanation, because this was done both in Taiwan and South Korea and heavily in China. But Taiwan proved to be quite effective in building up an interesting ecosystem to be in a powerful position for this business. Taiwan is not only powerful in the foundry business, it has a whole ecosystem built around it. So they have also some very important chip designers and chemicals needed for machines and assembly. So it's a bit a cost argument, because as long, and that's not just the US that didn't do it, also Europe, and now they're catching up with all kinds of CHIPS acts to incentivize companies to invest on their territory.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you about Europe in a moment, but just on the US, is there an effort in the US to get foundries built there?
There is, and I mean, part of this CHIPS Act, which has a total volume of what, 40 or even 50 billion US dollars, is subsidizing companies, foundry companies especially, to invest in the US. So what happened is that TSMC is about to make 5-nanometer chips in a plant in Arizona. This is partly due to this CHIPS Act, but also partly to Apple seeing some advantages and also some marketing advantages of saying, you know, our iPhone was almost entirely made in the US. It has chips made in the US. That's a good selling point. And of course, Apple is pushing TSMC to go more sophisticated. So TSMC has doubled down on this investment in Arizona, and it is planning to open a second production facility for 4-nanometer and 3-nanometer chips from 2024 onwards. The total investment sum for TSMC is 40 billion US dollars. And this is quite a win for the US. Interesting, by the way, before I forget it, when you look at investment, there is Moore's Law, but when this might come to an end, you might have another development where something doubles, and that's a cost to go more sophisticated. And here we see the difference of investment costs needed from the step of 7 to 5 nanometers. They basically double for chip design and for a fabrication plant. And this has not been the case in previous developments. So only for a difference of 2 so-called process node nanometers, you need to double the expense. Analysts are quite certain that this might continue. What is the consequence of that? It's basically that TSMC and Samsung have some near monopoly there to go more sophisticated, while even for the most powerful chip-making companies, it's very hard to go into this business. Intel, for example, is a market leader, a global market leader, but it lags about 3 years behind TSMC and Samsung.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, well, I mean, let me just sort of put the Asian geopolitical question to you, U.S. Asian, which is a pretty obvious one, that if Xi Jinping in China decided to take over Taiwan, what would the implication be for the U.S. in terms of chips? I mean, they're getting these plants in Arizona, which presumably after a time they'd be able to run without Taiwanese support, would they? So is the U.S. doing this largely to protect itself against that eventuality?
Yes and no. I mean, when you look at the numbers, Taiwan is the leading nation for this high-end foundry wafer production. And, you know, the plan of TSMC in Arizona is to make 600,000 wafers per year, while it makes 2 million wafers in Taiwan only in 1 month. So when you look at these dimensions, of course, yes, you can do reshoring, but this is only the tip of the iceberg. This is 3% of TSMC's output, maybe in the US. There's also a new factory plant in Japan. TSMC has been evaluating Germany as a location, but it is, when you look at the speeches by its CEO, Taiwan is still the major location. You know, when you look at this and when you look at what might happen, or just do a thought experiment like CSIS has been doing with this wargaming, the consequences would be devastating. I mean, we already see what is happening now with Russia's illegal war in Ukraine, but Taiwan is a different kind of actor. It's super important for the global economy, so that would be devastating. However, the more optimistic message is, and the keyword here is Silicon Shield. So that refers to Taiwan being too important for the world's supply of chips to be attacked. And China is in a bit of dilemma here, because on the one hand, it is very dependent on the world economy. The whole social contract between the party and citizens is based on economic growth, because if there is no growth, what can a party offer its citizens, right? On the other hand, the rhetoric concerning the status of Taiwan has become ever more aggressive. But if we look at the effect on the world economy, an invasion of Taiwan would be devastating and it would hurt China. And as long as China is not fully self-reliant in this chip industry, it would basically cut itself off its own ambition to become autonomous. Think of this famous Made in China 2025 policy. This is already impossible to achieve. The US has slowed down China's progress, and some people think it has done so deliberately to gain time for Taiwan to slow down China's progress. Because as long as China is not decoupled from the US, from Europe, from Taiwan, I would say an invasion would backfire on China. And then the question is it rhetorics now? Is it domestic policy problems related to the whole coronavirus pandemic that Xi wants to you know, rally the people behind him with this Taiwan policy? It might be the case, yes. But we might have some certainty that what is being said and what is being done are two kind of things. That's the optimistic version speaking here, of course.
There's obviously very delicate balances going on. I did say I'd ask you about Europe. So Taiwan and South Korea, China, you've talked about. Well, we haven't really asked how much China is doing internally, but you're saying basically they don't have control of the whole process yet or anything like it. And the US trying to catch up with its Asian competitors. So what about Europe? Where do they stand in the rankings of chip production? What can they do? What can't they do?
Well, Europe is, let's put it this way, in somewhat of an awkward position here, because it does not really have a high-end electronics industry. We don't have European Apple or Samsung. Supercomputers are made elsewhere. So you need to look at the European industry, which is it's anything but low tech either. Don't get me wrong here, but the industry that has suffered is car makers, for example, and there has been a multitude of reasons why these shortages happened, but little of them had anything to do that there were not enough production facilities in Europe. And I doubt that what is being said now in ambitious EU commissioner speeches is really going to make a difference. To me, it sounds a bit like they want to enter this race towards the most advanced microchips and saying things like, we must invest more to produce the world's most advanced chips in Europe, rather than what I would prefer. Let us bring chip assembly, for example, closer to our industry. Let us look at the supply chain. Let us fix choke points around there. Let us fix the weak links there where there's no resilience due to a lack of redundancies. And let's create production facilities for our industrial needs. This I don't really hear in these speeches. And that is a bit problematic because supply security is not determined by nanometers in any way. The shortage which occurred in Europe had different reasons. And Europe, don't get me wrong here again, it has quite important players as well. I already mentioned the ASML. It's a crucial supplier of chip production equipment. One EUV machine costs 150 million euros. And it's high in demand. And without it, TSMC and Samsung would not be able to produce the most advanced chips. There are also important chemical companies, traditional ones in Germany, for example, BASF, Linde, or Merck, and they are crucial suppliers of chip production. In Germany, you also have Siltronic, for example, which provides wafers for this chip production. ST Microelectronics, a Franco-Italian company, which is headquartered in Switzerland, is Europe's largest IDM. And in the UK as well, there are two companies with quite some importance for intellectual property. Still, of course, this ecosystem is not comparable with that of the US, Taiwan, or South Korea. But does it have to be comparable? I would say no.
Yeah, I get your point about that. You're saying that maybe Europe should concentrate on the lower end stuff they actually need rather than the high end stuff. But on the shortage, I was going to ask you about that, and I gather from what you just said that the shortage was more in the lower end chips. Why did it occur, though? I mean, in most industries, over time, supply does match up with demand. Why didn't that happen in the chip industry?
I would say with regards to the global situation, and I can come back to Europe then, there are four reasons. The first reason is this very fragile nature of the chip supply chain. Bear in mind, as I told you, there are many suppliers, a high degree of specialization, high degree of labor division. Also, it's worth mentioning that the purity requirements in a fabrication lab are very, very high. You need dust-free air, and dust-free means air 1,000 times cleaner than in a modern surgery department. That is very, very clean air. And you need stable temperature. And if only some of it deviates, this wafer which transistors are put on, it's unusable. So you have to start from scratch. Just to give you an example how delicate this process is. And, you know, with high specialization, in normal times, this is very efficient. But in the times of crises and uncertainties, there are little redundancies and little resilience. And when only one company can carry out a task, which does not even have to be critical or high-end in nature, and this one company gets into trouble for whatever reason, the whole supply chain is disrupted. This has been the case for a Japanese company, Ajinomoto, which is a global player from MSG, monosodium glutamate. But a side product of this company is interlayer insulating material called ABF. It's Ajinomoto built-up film. And this is needed for the assembly, the last stage of high-performance central processor units. And this ABF is not very lucrative for this Japanese company. And therefore, for example, scaling up production of this ABF was not a top business priority. So what happened during the height of this shortage was that the chips were made, they were ready to be assembled, but they were waiting at this assembly for this cheap but rare insulating material. As a consequence, last summer, Intel has announced to integrate ABF capacities in its assembly and testing facilities in Vietnam in order to reduce these dependencies. So that's the first reason. It's a very fragile industry. And on top of that, which, you know, that's just a structural problem, which is present for years. On top of that came a geopolitical rivalry, which intensified. It started under Obama, but it really intensified under President Trump, former President Trump. And this rivalry between China and the US is also a great deal about who has the technological edge. And here, what happened is that this export control regime from the US had the effect, it happened in 2019, that a lot of Chinese companies feared that there might be more. And what do you do when there's a threat looming that you might be cut off chips? You buy them and you stockpile them. And this, of course, has a global effect that when a huge country like China starts piling up US chips in stock, there's an increased demand for chips and a shortage of supply. And this was already before the pandemic broke out. Now the pandemic, in combination with this fragile nature of the supply chain, on top of this stockpiling, meant that there was a huge market imbalance. And not only in the chip industry, think of the mask business, for example, but unlike the chip business, which it cannot catch up, it cannot scale up production like making these face masks, it was not able to catch up. And then again, you had risen demand for equipment needed for home office, for example, or electronic home entertainment purposes, such as gaming consoles. So this came during the coronavirus, and a lot of car manufacturers canceled their chip orders because they thought that demand will be low for a long time, but demand actually went up quicker than they thought, and these chips were already the canceled one built in elsewhere. For example, regulating the temperature in a laptop somewhere in someone's home office. So that was, for example, the problem for the European car makers. And fourth, on top of everything, there comes climate change. And with climate change, there come increased extreme weather events, which happened throughout the year 2021 at quite important chip production locations. You probably remember the winter storm in Texas leading to power outages. Now, these outages had severe consequences for text-based chip fabrication plants run by Samsung, NXP, or Infineon. The latter two are very important chip suppliers for the car making industry. In Taiwan as well, insufficient winter rain amounts resulted in droughts. And this has consequences for both the water supply and hydroelectric power supply. As a consequence, there were power outages in TSMC's chip fabrication plants. And as I told you, you need stable temperatures. So when you have a power outage, the whole fabrication process is lost. You need to start from scratch. So there are basically four reasons that led to this a huge global shortage. And in Europe, I think the car makers made poor judgments about demands and also relied a great deal on this principle of just-in-time production.
Well, that really helps us understand the industry, actually, just hearing those vulnerabilities. And well, finally, let me just ask you to look ahead. I guess, you know, beyond the risk of shortages and surveillance issues, that the big thing is, might this lead to conflict? Are chips so important that they could be the basis of armed conflict? You say you've done some war gaming in your think tank. What's your view on it?
Personally, I'm always cautious about using words such as war. So this use in headlines of trade war and tech cold war and chip war, I'm not a big fan of it because it is misleading. I think chip wars or trade wars, you know, it's a bit dangerous to use these terminologies. And to be fair, you know, these kind of chip shortages I was speaking about, it's still a very so-called first world problem. It's a luxury to wait for your car. It's a luxury to wait for your laptop. It's a luxury to wait 2 months more for your coffee machine. The real problem is when you don't have electricity or warm water, like in Ukraine. The real problem is when you don't have food. These are real shortages. So we need to distinguish here about basic needs and luxury needs. And I think for basic needs, the threshold to go to war is substantially higher than about supercomputers and laptops. And, you know, I've spoken about this Silicon Shield of Taiwan. Why is that important? It might also discourage China of invading Taiwan, because what is logical, what Taiwan would do, is to destroy important chip making facilities before the enemy reaches hands on them, either equipment, machine, or know-how. So it's basically raising the costs for an invader, discourage them to do that. It's, you know, in the battlefield, you destroy bridges to make more obstacles, and in the high tech industry, you can threaten to destroy it, and with that, everyone goes down. So I don't think you would expect someone to go to war over chips. Wars might rather happen for ideological reasons.
It's great to hear such an optimistic assessment.
Yes, that's the optimist realist speaking me.
thank you, Julian Camassa, for guiding us through this very interesting issue of chips and how they're made and how important they are and what they might mean in terms of geopolitics. So thanks very much.
Thank you for having me, and I'm happy to have contributed something in here and shed some light. There's still a lot of nitty-gritty in this industry, but yeah, giving an overview was a pleasure for me. Thank you.